Welcome back to the Curtis Research Audio Archive.
It's good to be back.
Today, we're taking a look at the history of Kilis. That's a city right on Turkey's southern border next to Syria.
Mm-hmm. And we've gathered quite a few sources that explore its past, you know, its historical connections to Kurdish populations, and also how it's changed more recently, especially with the impact of the Syrian refugee crisis.
Right. So our aim today is really to unpack Kilis's, well, its long and pretty complex story. From ancient times right up to now.
Highlighting its strategic spot, the mix of cultures, and importantly for our archive, those links, historical and current, with Kurdish communities.
Okay, so the story of people living around Kilis goes back a very long time, doesn't it?
It really does. We're talking millennia. The earliest evidence we have is from the Chalcolithic period. That's around the 4th millennium BC.
Wow, Chalcolithic. So that's Copper Age, roughly.
Yeah, that sort of transition between stone and bronze. There's a place called Oylum Hoyuk, a huge ancient mound nearby, and it shows people lived there almost continuously through all sorts of different eras. It just highlights how important this location always was.
And that location itself, it's so key, isn't it? Kind of sitting right where the Anatolian Plateau meets the Syrian plain.
Exactly. A natural control point for trade routes. Plus, the land was fertile, you know, watered by the Akpinar River. Just a prime spot, really.
So which big ancient powers were involved there?
Well, you had a whole sequence, traces of the Hatchins, then the Hittites they left finds at Kuzayn.
Kuzayn, okay.
And interestingly, Assyrian cuneiform texts mention a place called Kilisi. Many think that's the origin of the name Kilis.
Kilisi.
Yeah, suggesting it was probably part of those old Assyrian trading networks very early on.
That's fascinating. The name itself echoing back so far. What came after the Bronze Age empires?
Then you get into the Iron Age, Phrygians, Medes, eventually the Achaemenid Persians. Then Alexander the Great sweeps through.
Ah, the Hellenistic period.
Right, under the Seleucid Empire.
Yeah.
And there's another possible name origin here, too. A city called Krubus, or Kiris, maybe. It means lord in Greek. Could be another root for Kilis.
So layers of names, layers of power. What about the Romans? They must have been there.
Oh, yeah. They took control around the 1st century BC, brought, you know, Roman stability, built things. There's Roman evidence at Kuzayn again, and a significant center called Chorus, or Kiris, near Kilis.
Chorus.
They even had a name for it. Silesia, Sever, or Nadiganti. Shows it was on their map, definitely.
And then the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantines.
Yep. From 395 AD, Kilis became part of the Byzantine Empire. It was a frontier town facing off against the Sasanian Persians in the east. Stayed Byzantine until the big Islamic conquests in the 7th century.
So always a borderland, it seems.
Pretty much, yeah. A place where cultures and empires met and clashed.
Okay, let's shift gears then. The medieval period. I guess that brought some major changes.
Huge changes. First, the Arab Muslim conquest in 636 AD under Caliph Umar. Byzantine rule ended.
And Kilis became...
It became a thur, basically a fortified frontier outpost facing the Byzantines. Then, later, especially after the Battle of Manzikert in 1071, Turkic peoples started arriving.
The Seljuks.
Mm-hmm. Seljuk Turks settled in and around Kilis from about 1084 onwards. That really started the process of Turkification and broader Islamization in the area.
And the Crusades must have swept through, too.
They certainly did. Kilis got caught up in that. For a while, it was even linked to the Crusader county of Edessa. Rivanda Castle nearby became a Crusader stronghold. Shows how strategic it was.
But Muslim rule was eventually restored.
Yes. After the Seljuks weakened and the Crusader states fell, the Ayyubids took over. That's the dynasty founded by Saladin.
Who was of Kurdish origin, interestingly.
Exactly. Then later, it came under the Mamluk Sultanate, based in Egypt, from about 1250 until the Ottomans arrived in 1517. Rivanda Castle was a Mamluk base, too, and you can still see Mamluk influence in some Kilis mosques, like Akrun and Ulu Mosque, both built in 1334.
So Byzantine, Arab, Seljuk, Crusader, Ayyubid, Mamluk. Quite the list.
A real crossroads, constantly changing hands.
Right. Now, this next phase is particularly interesting for our archive, the Emirate of Kilis, a Kurdish principality. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is fascinating. It sort of emerges in that transition time between the Ayyubids and Mamluks, and actually lasts quite a while, right into the early Ottoman era, maybe up to around 1610.
And what area did it cover?
It governed Kilis itself, Afrin, and lands stretching towards Aleppo, a significant pocket of local Kurdish power.
And the ruling family.
They trace their lineage back to a figure named Sheikh Mend from the Hakkari region.
Hakkari.
Okay.
And his father, Sheikh Fakhreddin, is considered a really important figure in Yazidi philosophy.
Wait, really? So there might have been an early Yazidi connection to this ruling family.
It's a suggestion based on that lineage, yeah. Mm-hmm. Alongside Sunni Islam, which was also clearly present, so a potentially complex religious background there.
That's a detail you don't often hear. How did they get established?
Well, the story goes that Sheikh Mend was appointed ruler by the Ayyubids. Maybe he had good relations with Saladin, it's possible. He gained status, known as Miramiram.
Prince of princes?
Exactly. So initially they were sort of vassals of the Ayyubids.
And under the Mamluks, how did that work?
Well, the Mamluks first recognized Menkaûm, a descendant of Sheikh Mend. But later, Mamluk favor shifted to someone else, Izzeddin. Despite that, Qasim seems to have kept his local power base going, shows some resilience.
Until the Ottomans arrived.
Right. Early 16th century, Menkaûm actually supported the Ottomans initially.
Oh.
But it didn't end well for him. He was later executed in Istanbul, probably the Ottomans wanting to centralize control.
Sounds about right. But the family persisted.
They did. The Kampalat family, Jean Boulad, is another form of the name. Menkaûm's son, Kampalat Bey, became the Ottoman governor. The Sentak Bey of Kili is around the mid-1500s, ruling until 1572. The Kampalat Mosque in Kili's, that was built during his time, a visible sign of their continued influence.
But things weren't always smooth with Istanbul, were they?
Definitely not. The Kampalats often governed, but there was internal fighting and clashes with Ottoman authority. That classic tension between local power and the central empire.
And it came to a head.
Big time. Kampalat's grandson, Ali Pasha Jean Boulad, rose high. He became Baylerbey, governor general of Aleppo. But then he launched a massive rebellion against the Ottomans around 1606, 1607. He was aiming for independence, basically.
A major gamble.
Huge. But it failed. The Ottoman Grand Vizier, Kuyuku Murad Pasha, crushed the rebellion. Ali Pasha was caught and executed in 1610.
And that was the end of the emirate.
Pretty much the end of it as any kind of autonomous power. The Kampalat influence in Kili's itself really faded after that. The main branch of the family actually fled, ending up in Lebanon around 1630.
Becoming the Jumblat family.
Exactly. Still a major name in Lebanese politics today. It's quite a lineage tracing back to that Kili's emirate. A fascinating story of a local Kurdish power navigating these huge empires.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Rojbosh Hannah.
Ah, perfect timing. Rojbosh.
Let's see what Hannah's brought today. Sound of sipping.
Hmm.
Oh, this is nice. It's got that lovely warmth. The spices are really balanced today. Not too strong on the cardamom like last time. What do you think? Rojbosh, Hannah, Destiny Saxby, thanks so much.
Sound of sipping. You're right, this is really smooth today. Just the right amount of sweetness, I think, really hits the spot. Excellent chai, Anna.
Perfect. Okay, let's just take a moment, enjoy this lovely chai, and we'll be right back to Ottoman Kili's.
Sounds good.
Okay, welcome back. That chai was exactly what we needed.
Definitely.
So before the break, we were talking about the end of the Emirate of Kili's, Ali Pasha's rebellion failing, and the Ottomans fully consolidating control. What did Kili's look like under the Ottomans then?
Well, after the Battle of Marj Dabiq in 1516, Kili's was officially part of the Ottoman Empire within the vilayet or province of Aleppo. It started off relatively small.
But what about the Kurdish presence? Did the Ottomans acknowledge that?
They did, actually. Around 1527, they established something called the Ekrad Sanjak.
A Sanjak of the Kurds.
Exactly. A Sanjak was an administrative district. Creating this one, which included Kili's and nearby Azez, was a clear recognition of the Kurdish tribes in that border area.
So, not granting independence, but acknowledging their existence within the system.
Precisely. And how it was administered often involved something called yurtluk okokluk, sort of hereditary control. Local leaders, often tribal chiefs, were given authority over the area, passed down in the family in return for duties owed to the state, like providing troops or maintaining order.
And who held that position in the Sanjak of the Kurds initially?
A figure named Ezzeddin Bey became the Sanjak Bey around 1527. He must have been quite powerful because the nomadic groups there actually became known as the Akrada Izzedinli, the Kurds of Izzedinli.
Named after him. So these Izzedinli Kurds, what do we know about them?
They were a large group, semi-nomadic, possibly connected to the bigger Buzulis Turkmen Confederation. They moved with their herds, you know, summer pastures, winter pastures around Kilis and Uzes.
How large a group are we talking?
Estimates from the early 18th century mention something like 5,000 tents. That's a lot of people and huge numbers of livestock. They were a major demographic and economic factor.
And their relationship with the Ottoman state, was it stable?
It fluctuated. There were periods of integration. But then, especially in the 18th century, the Ottomans tried to impose new taxes, the Hazari and Seferi.
And the tribes weren't happy.
Not at all. There was resistance, sometimes turning into banditry. The Ottomans tried forced resettlement to control them, but that wasn't always very successful. It shows the difficulty of ruling these mobile groups on the fringes.
And did the Campolat family connection disappear entirely?
Not completely. Even after Izzeddin Bey, members of the Campolat family still served as Ottoman Sinkak Beys in the area at times. So some continuity of local leadership, even after their independent power was broken.
And Kilis town itself, did it grow under the Ottomans?
Yes. It developed into a proper regional center. Trade flourished silk, cotton, leather goods, and agriculture was key. Grapes, olives, Kilis olive oil, still famous, pistachios, cereals.
So economic activity fueled growth.
Right. You see mosques being built, mausoleums, dervish lodges, public baths. That distinctive stone architecture really took shape then.
But it wasn't all smooth sailing in the later Ottoman centuries, I suppose?
No, definitely not. Kilis faced its share of troubles. Natural disasters hit hard. There was a bad drought in 1818, earthquakes in the 1820s, plague outbreaks like one in 1826.
And political turmoil.
Yes, there was internal strife. Egyptian forces actually occupied the area for a time in 1831. Plus, things like famine, locust plagues, life could be precarious. And then you have the 19th century Tanzimat reforms trying to modernize the empire, which likely put pressure on those local autonomies we talked about.
Okay, let's move toward the end of the Ottoman era. The late 19th, early 20th century, World War I, and the birth of the Republic, a period of massive change.
Huge upheaval. By around 1900, Kilis was a significant town, a Khaza administrative center within the Aleppo Vilayet, population maybe around 20,000.
And still diverse.
Very diverse. You had Muslims, Turks, Kurds, Arabs, Circassians, but also a really significant Armenian community right in the town, plus Greeks and Jews. Population records from 1914 show this mix clearly. It was a typical late Ottoman Levantine city in that sense.
Which leads us, unfortunately, to 1915.
Yes. Tragically, Kilis was hit hard by the Armenian genocide. The sources describe deportations starting in late July 1915. Armenians were forced out, marched towards a camp near Katma Station.
Under horrific conditions, presumably.
Appalling conditions. Forced marches, starvation, violence. The Armenian church in Kilis was desecrated. Properties were seized. Women and children abducted. It's a deeply tragic part of the city's history. A terrible loss of a whole community.
After World War I ended, the Ottoman Empire collapsed. What happened in Kilis immediately after?
Chaos, essentially. Allied forces occupied the region, first the British, then the French. This foreign occupation fueled Turkish nationalism.
And Kilis became involved in the resistance.
Yes, it became quite an important center for the Turkish nationalist movement during the War of Independence from 1919 to 1922. There was active local resistance against the French.
Until the French withdrew.
Right. The Ankara Agreement in 1921 led to the French withdrawal, and Turkish forces retook Kilis on December 7th, 1921. Then the Turkish Republic was established in 1923, and the Treaty of Lausanne finalized the borders.
And this had a huge impact on Kilis's position, didn't it?
Absolutely massive. Suddenly, Kilis was cut off from Aleppo, its historic economic and cultural center to the south. It became a border town overnight. And crucially, the new republic was founded on unitary Turkish nationalism, which had profound consequences for the Kurdish population and any aspirations for autonomy they might have held.
So a major shift from being part of a wider region to being right on the edge. How did Kilis fare through most of the 20th century before the recent Syrian crisis?
Well, for decades, it was administratively part of Gaziantep province. It only became its own province, Turkey's 79th, relatively recently, in the mid-1990s, June 1995, I think.
And economically?
Still heavily reliant on agriculture. Olives, as we mentioned, famous for oil. Grapes, pistachios, cotton, wheat, tobacco, too. Livestock farming as well. Industry. Some efforts, but it remained limited. Tourism potential was there with all the history, but maybe underdeveloped. Road connections did improve over time.
And culturally, did it keep its distinct character?
It seems so. People point to the Ottoman-era architecture, those mosques, mausoleums, baths, the traditional stone houses. Handicrafts continued, like duvet making, embroidery, stone carving.
Local traditions.
Yeah, folklore around local shrines, Koftechi Baba, Kukutide. Folk poems called mani, reflecting local life, and food played a huge role in rituals and daily life.
Ah, the food. You mentioned the influences before.
Right. It's this amazing blend. Influences from Aleppo and Syria, obviously, but also Turkish and broader Mediterranean touches. Lamb, bulgur, olive oil, lots of spices are key.
What are some signature dishes?
Oh, there's kilis tava. That's a famous baked meat and vegetable dish. Oruk, which are like stuffed meat patties. Kubul mushfiye, another type of stuffed meatball. Ekşili melhuta, a sour lentil soup. Lebaniye, a yogurt soup. Loads of different dolmas and kaftas.
Sounds incredible.
Yeah.
And desserts.
Oh, yeah. Katmer, that flaky pastry. Senet shamuru, heaven's mud. A semolina dessert. Pinyar helvasa, cheese halva. And jaribis, these semolina cookies often filled with pistachios or walnuts. A really rich culinary scene.
It really paints a picture of a place with deep roots and strong local traditions. Which brings us inevitably to the last decade or so and the Syrian refugee crisis starting in 2011. That must have changed Kilis profoundly.
Profoundly is the right word. Kilis became one of the main entry points for Syrians fleeing the war. And it wasn't just an entry point. It became a major host city.
To the point where,
at its peak, there were actually more Syrian refugees living in Kilis than native Turkish residents. An incredible demographic transformation.
That's staggering. What did that mean economically? It must have been hugely complex.
Very complex, with both positive and negative impacts reported. On the one hand, you had a large influx of low-wage labor, mostly in the informal sector.
Which affected local workers.
Yes. Sources suggested displaced some Turkish workers and definitely put downward pressure on wages in those informal jobs. But some analyses also suggest it might have pushed some low-skilled native workers into slightly better, more formal jobs, occupational upgrading, they call it.
What about prices?
Housing and food prices went up because of demand. But for other goods and services, especially those using informal labor, prices might have actually decreased. Refugees also consumed goods and started businesses, adding to economic activity.
So a mixed bag economically.
Pretty much. Some studies even suggest a small positive impact on Turkey's overall GDP from the refugee presence. But, and this is a big but, it put an immense strain on local public finances. Schools, hospitals, sanitation, all stretched incredibly thin.
And socially. How did people cope with such a massive, rapid change?
Well, initially, there is a lot of hospitality, a real welcome. But as the crisis dragged on years and years and the numbers stayed so high, tensions inevitably grew.
Why? What were the main friction points?
Some local residents started blaming refugees for economic difficulties, for the strain on services. Concerns about cultural differences were sometimes voiced. It's a difficult situation when resources are stretched and communities are under pressure.
And for the refugees themselves, ongoing challenges.
Absolutely. Access to quality education, healthcare, decent housing remain major issues for many. And sadly, in situations of such vulnerability, you also see serious protection concerns, like child labor or early marriage, becoming problems within parts of the refugee community.
It really underscores how Kilis' story is just so tied to its geography, doesn't it? Always at a crossroads, shaped by empires, cultures, movements of people.
Yeah, from being an ancient settlement controlling trade routes to, well, a modern city on the front line of a huge humanitarian crisis. It's always been a frontier, a place of connection, yes, but also often a place of conflict and challenge.
And those historical connections to Kurdish populations, the Emirate, the Ottoman Sanjak, even the present day, that adds such a vital layer to understanding the region's, you know, it's an incredibly complex identity.
Mm-hmm. It's not a simple story. And this latest chapter, the huge demographic shift because of the Syrian crisis, it's just another massive turning point in the long, long story of this resilient border city.
So reflecting on all this history, all these layers, it really makes you wonder, doesn't it? What does the future hold for Kilis, a city that's seen millennia of change and is still right there, adapting to the shifting realities of the region? That's certainly something to think about as you consider everything we've discussed today.